Like to call to order the Data Practices Subcommittee. Ms. Novinsky will note the roll. I don't believe we have the approval of any minutes unless, okay. And so then the next item on the agenda is House File 1466. Representative Scott, who's actually the chair of this subcommittee, of course, has the first bill up, and I understand you have a bill up in another committee as well, so I'll have to be a little flexible.
Correct.
Tonight. So if you'd like to move your bill for consideration by the subcommittee.
Yes, I'd like to move House File 1466, and then I do have an amendment as well.
Right. And the amendment is?
The amendment is the H-1466-A2. A2 amendment.
All right. And Representative Scott, do you want to go through your bill first, or do you want to put the amendment on your bill to get it in the shape you want to discuss?
Let's
or
put that amendment on. Do we have another amendment? No, just the first item. These incorporate.
I guess I think it's the A1 amendment that.
Yep, I have an A1 and an A2. Madam Chair. And members, the A1 makes some. It puts back in the bill some things that we had removed from the bill, from the technical bill. And pretty much any time you see, turn to page 2, I guess. And where it says all government data, and in the bill it's collected, created, received, or disseminated is all marked through, and we're putting that back in its original form.
All right. Members, are there any questions on the A1 amendment to House File 1466? Representative Lesh.
So I'm sorry, I'm missing the nuance here. Yeah, I know, I understand that, but what's that do?
Because Representative Lesh, by deleting Section 9 from the bill, then the current language would stand. In other words, we wouldn't delete those words out of statute.
I understand that, but why are those words significant? Because all government data flat, as opposed to all government data collected, created, received, or disseminated, what are we now excluding by thereby re-including those words? You know?
Madam Chair, I'll have Lori Beyer-Kopinski is here at the testifiers table. I'll have her introduce herself. And
all right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Lori Beyer-Kopinski, Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Administration. The amendment addresses a concern that Mr. Neumeister brought to us. The amendment reinstates just in Section 1303 back to its original form, which is the laundry list of government data definition. This is one of the two places where the government data definition has our public presumption. So for historical value, we agreed with Mr. Neumeister that the laundry list of terms should be included back as in the original form in this one section.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, Representative Scott will renew our motion that the A1 amendment be adopted. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Scott, do you want to take the A2 amendment at this time, or?
Yes, and I'll have Ms. Kopinski speak to that, too.
Madam Chair and members, this is an amendment that comes to Representative Abler, and it is on behalf of the Department of Human Services. So I would ask Mr. Kerber to speak to the amendment, if possible.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kerber.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you'd like to explain the A2 amendment, which is part of Representative Abler's bill, I have it here in front of me, House File 1461. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the Director of the Licensing Division at the Department of Human Services. And in this short amendment, there are two things that are really being changed here, in addition to some of the technical amendments that are presented elsewhere in the bill. The first one is on page 2. On lines 2.12 through 2.23, what's really happening here is, in addition to making it a little bit more easy to read, there's a slight expansion of the information that's going to be made public by the Department of Human Services. Currently, if somebody is just if we're talking about license holders here, we're not talking about individuals who work for license holders or anything like that. We're talking about people who apply for a license and are granted a license. If those individuals have a disqualification under the background study system, currently the fact that they are disqualified is public data. If their disqualification is because of maltreatment, then the fact that they are disqualified and the maltreatment being the reason is public data. And that's if it's combined with a licensing sanction. What this is proposing is to expand that just slightly so that for these license holders, and the new language is really on page 2, line 20, the reason for the disqualification is public data. That's the expansion that's occurring here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Are there any questions for Mr. Kerber? Seeing none, is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in favor or opposition to the A2 amendment? Mr. Neumeister, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I do have a concern about publicly that information being disclosed, which has not been disclosed before. I have spoken with Chairperson Abler, and I'm just familiar with this bill just recently, and so I'm just raising at least on record. I'm going to interact a little bit more with Mr. Kerber and get some more of the history and work with Mr. Abler and Ms. Scott, deciding if Mr. Abler decides to go in a different perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. And for members of the audience and members of the committee, I think what we're going to try and do tonight is hear all of these bills and look to bring a subcommittee report to the Civil Law Committee on Thursday. And so there might be some more work needed on some of these policy issues, as is usually the case with the data practices issues. So we'll try and get through hearing all of them, but may not adopt all of the bills or amendments this evening. All right, Representative Scott.
I guess, have we voted on the A2?
We have not voted on it. Okay, I don't think there's any additional testimony, any questions by committee members. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion or the amendment is adopted. Ms. Scott, or Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to have Ms. Beyer-Kopinski go through the technical bill. It's pretty self-explanatory, but we'll let her go through it.
Welcome to the
committee. Madam Chair and members, Lori Beyer-Kopinski. House File 1466 is the Department of Administration bill that makes grammatical and technical changes to the Data Practices Act, as well as the Open Meeting Law. The bill improves clarity, readability, and understanding of these laws. The bill inserts the term government data throughout Chapter 13, which regulates government data of government entities. Government data is defined to mean, take a deep breath, data collected, created, received, maintained, or disseminated by a government entity. So try and say that really quickly. It's a mouthful. And throughout the Act, you will sometimes see all of those terms used, sometimes half of them, sometimes just one or two. And by making this change to the defined phrase government data, you'll be ensuring that no matter how government gets data, it will be consistently covered by the Act. This will remove confusion, improve readability and clarity for and help citizens. My office handles thousands of calls from citizens each year, so we know firsthand how challenging it can be to interpret specific sections when one of the more of the terms are left out. So last year, the legislature fixed this issue in Section 1343, which is personnel data about government employees. And before you changed it, 1343 was limited only to data collected about government employees, when it appeared that your intent was to cover all data about government employees. So based on the types of data that were discussed in that section, an employee's work title, their payroll information, changing the term to collected from collected to maintained helped clarify that. And at the time, in 2009, when you heard testimony, folks encouraged that this change be made to the rest of the Act to improve readability. Other technical changes are being made throughout that I'm happy to elaborate on if there are other questions, but this is the major. We also are changing data is to data are and fixing some of the old-fashioned ways that data privacy and data practices was described. We also add open meeting law data coded elsewhere. So in the open meeting law, there will now be a running list of organizations that are subject to the open meeting law, which is, we hope, going to be really helpful for people trying to figure out who's subject to the open meeting law and who isn't.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure, Ms. Barkopensky, that I understand what you said at the very beginning about the that by using the word government data, you believe that we're getting rid of any concerns that people might have throughout the bill by the striking of language. For example, if you look on page 4, if you look on lines 4.24 and 4.25, and another example is on the next page on line 5.21. These are examples where the bill adds government data but gets rid of some of these other qualifiers, created, collected, received on 4.24 and 4.25, and on the next page gets rid of created, collected, etc. So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that by calling it government data, and because that's now a defined term, we don't need those terms because those are included in the definition of government data. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, yes. Government data is the key defined term, and we needed a verb to tie it all together, and maintained of the list is the most inclusive of all the other terms, so that's why we use that. But we really were just looking for a verb to tie it back to that definition of government data.
But Ms. Byer-Kopinski, can you tell us where you've defined government data? I'm missing that here. Is it?
It's actually not one of the sections that we're changing in the bill. Let me... I don't have my chapter 13 handy. It is in 1302. So it's already an existing law.
If you want, I guess I can read it if you want. It is 1302 subdivision 7, government data. Government data means all data collected, created, received, maintained, or disseminated by any government entity, regardless of its physical form, storage, media, or conditions of use. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Byer-Kopensky, I just want to make sure, because there are several examples that I flagged. I know I didn't catch them all, but I guess I can do this offline, but there are several instances throughout the bill where maintained... We leave maintained and we cross out those other words, and I just want to make sure that they're all covered and that those others are all covered. I trust you,
Chair,
but is that what you're
Simon,
saying?
Yes. Okay. The definition Byer-Kopinski. That, Madam Chair, Representative Simon, that's the definition of government data that Representative Fulberg just read.
Okay.
They're all included and remain included.
And there are other areas of the bill that you want? Have you explained everything that's in here before I take testimony from the public? I'm sorry, Representative Simon.
And Madam Chair, are we talking about the whole bill here, the 1466 is introduced here?
Yeah, and as amended, but I don't think there was questions.
Right.
As amended.
I do have a question.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Ms. Byer-Kopensky, I see that line 24.10, there's something about ethanol producer payments. And could you explain what that is and why it's in the bill? It's section 52 of the bill. It's adding a subdivision 13 to 13.6435, and because I don't have 13.6435 in front of me, I don't know what that is.
Ms. Byer-Kopensky.
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, that is adding a cross-reference in 13. We try and keep cross-references so that you can find data coded elsewhere.
And so just to clarify, this exact language is also included in 41A.09.
Okay. Thanks.
Madam Chair, yes.
All right, any other questions from committee members? From Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a technical question for a technical bill. Whose idea was it, Ms. Byer-Kopensky, to change the singular to the plural, change is to are?
Ms. Byer-Kopensky.
Madam Chair and members, all of my staff are very good grammaticians. Is that the right word? I am not. It is very important to them that data is a plural form. So we are correcting it and making it consistent.
Madam Chair, I always thought it was a collective noun like money or water, but if the grammarians in your office think differently, then who am I to prevent that foot in the door? Thank you.
All right. Are there any individuals in the audience that would like to speak to House File 1466 as amended? If you'd step to the stand, please. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gimberling. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Gimberling. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, which is an organization of citizens and journalists and lawyers who try and make sure that the public gets maximum access to government information. So, some of you know that I've been associated with the Data Practices Act since before it was the Data Practices Act, since 1973. And I just want to make a few comments about the technical bill. Following up on Representative Lesch's comment, the discussion about is and are, you go on like a 3-4 year cycle and have that discussion. It started with Senator Miriam, as whom some of you know was an extreme grammarian. Your conclusion has always been to use popular usage, which is why is in here. So, and I don't think it has a great effect either way, but there is a history. So, following up on Representative Simon's comments, one of the things I wondered about is the change to using government data, not just consistent in the bill, but consistent throughout Chapter 13. I didn't know if you want to branch out to the whole body of Minnesota statutes, because there are 200-300 other sections of Minnesota statutes that classify data, but I think part of what you're trying to do is attain consistency, so you might want to think about that. Perhaps you could give the reviser an instruction to look at that and come back to you next year and tell you if indeed that is consistent. One of the issues that I've heard that people are concerned about is you put more heavy emphasis on the word maintains now than ever before. And the problem with that is there's no definition of maintains in the statute. So it then has its common and ordinary meaning, which means most of us go look in the dictionary. And I went and looked in the Webster's Unabridged one that you can barely lift. It says things like preserve, update, that kind of thing. And what you might want to think about doing is putting a definition of maintains in the statute. Now, why is that important? Well, you know, I spent lots of years talking to government agencies who would come up with the most amazing arguments that the data that they had, they didn't have, okay? Which, of course, means you escape all kinds of obligations under the Data Practices Act, including the obligation to make public data available to the public. I don't think you ever want to open those opportunities, because if you open them, they'll take them. Okay, that's just the way it works. So a definition of maintains might be helpful. I scratched something out this afternoon. It's a lot of words, but I think it tries to accomplish what you've always tried to accomplish all along, which is to make sure that government data really is regulated by the statute. So if you wanted to hear that amendment, I'd be happy to discuss it with you. One thing I noticed in reading case law with data practice stuff and reading case law in general with statutory things, the courts say, well, the legislature changed this, and they must have meant something when they changed it. So I think you have to be real careful when you change things without having a court somewhere say, well, oh, wait a minute, that's not what we really meant. And the only example of that I could find in here is section 22 on page 7. The language in that's being deleted has been here for, I won't say eons, but for a long time. And I don't think it's the intent of the author or the intent of IPAD to really say that all welfare data is private, okay? But if you look at that, you could conceivably read it that way. Okay? That with the change, it's important that this is about the change. So I don't know if it hurts to just leave it the way it is, because as I said, it's been there for a long time. I think this is part of the idea of trying to use the term government data consistently. But that's one that caught my eye as to might get misinterpreted. Now, I don't know if there's anybody here from DHS. They might not care, but that, like I said, that one caught my attention. So those are all the comments I have. Appreciate your attention, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Representative Simon.
Thank you. Mr. Gamberling, thanks. We always appreciate your insight on these issues, given your long history with this law. So thanks for taking your time. I'm intrigued by the idea of a definition for maintain. I see what you're saying now. Even if it's true that the definition of government data includes data that is maintained, collected, used, disseminated, etc., that's just taking a narrow subset. And to say government data is one thing, but then to say it's maintained, we don't have a separate definition of maintained. I don't know that it's practical to do that here tonight, but maybe in time for the markup of the big bill in civil law, maybe Chair Scott and others can take a look at what I'd be very interested in seeing your formulation or others, because I think on the surface of it, I'd be interested in Ms. Breyer-Kaprensky's thoughts about that, but my reaction to that is I think that is a safe approach if we're going to do it that way, just so that we don't provide kind of unnecessary and unintentional wiggle room for people to get out of their responsibility, or at least what we intend, I think. So I'm intrigued by the idea. That's
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I just gave Representative Scott my chicken scratch, which some of you know my handwriting is horrible, but hopefully I've done a better job than I usually do.
Madam Chair, I could read every word.
And I'm sure that we can get that out in an email to subcommittee members to provide feedback or comment to Representative Scott prior to Thursday's civil law committee. So are there any additional questions for Mr. Gamberling? Any additional comments, Mr. Gamberling?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record.
Yes. Madam Chair, members, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers, and I also head the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lee.
Thank you. The reason I'm here is that we had some language that we were trying to create to fix a problem in a broader bill that was traveling. I guess the subject matter was traveling in other committees too, and the issue as it was broken down always seemed to be that it was a data practices piece or a data issue that nobody knew how to deal with. So we were in the revisor's office as far as trying to create the language to fix the problem, and then noticing that in the department's bill they might actually have some of the sections that may address the issue. To explain, we've been working on problems that were created in the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, so all our work has been in that area. And one of the things that they do is they have four funders, one being Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, two are foundations, and one is the Minnesota Home Ownership Center, which contributes to a fund that is then given to grantees to do housing counseling and training. They created a new internal rule this past year related to any grantees receiving funds must put their forms on and all their client data and everything they collect on a form created by the Minnesota Home Ownership Center, which has all the client data. You're talking about private, confidential data, and I notice in the list that you're addressing, you know, all types of things, whether it be Social Security numbers and so forth. Putting it on the Minnesota Home Ownership form, and if you didn't, the word from the department was, if you didn't put it on this form, then you weren't eligible or you shouldn't be applying for the grant. Okay, yeah. To keep it short, the issue is the Home Ownership Center then owns the grantee's client data as if it were their own. And we understand that they applied for federal funds, which we haven't heard whether any of the funds then go to the grantees based on that data or go to the department, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We assume it's being kept within the Minnesota Home Ownership Center to use on client data that is really not their own, it is the grantees. And so what we were trying to do was put language that says no subcontractor of a state agency has the right to own somebody else's data or a grantee agency's data or client data and so forth.
And Ms. Lee, I think you have enough for a separate bill here. This isn't an issue we're going to be able to address by an amendment in committee tonight. If you'd like to make an appointment to talk to myself or Representative Scott in the meantime, but there's a number of nuances to your concerns that are not going to be able to be addressed here in the subcommittee tonight without having any bill or a written amendment in front of the committee to consider.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. But the sections we were looking at was 1303 and 1335 as far as tweaking some of that language that might solve the problem.
And the base bill is very technical in nature and not reforming any kind of a data classification or dissemination policy. So we need to look at something either in a bill form. It sounds like it's a rather complex issue, and we'll probably have to go to another policy committee that governed Minnesota Housing Finance as well. So certainly we appreciate your testimony here this evening, but it's not an issue that we're going to be able to address during the subcommittee tonight.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Is there any other testimony on House File 1466?
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Neumeister had one.
All right.
Welcome
to the committee, Mr. Neumeister, if you'll state your name for the record, please.
Rich Neumeister. Okay, I've looked at the A2 amendment. I do have a concern. I've been involved in helping develop the licensing process for human services since its inception almost 22 years, 21 years ago, maybe give or take a year or two. One of the things that have been a very strong provision of it is that if you're denied, there is a privacy interest there. And it's cracked a little bit when you take a look on page 2, on lines 13 and 18, you use the word applicant. I have no problem if your current license and the background check is done and you get, you know, boom, you're held, you know, you're found out. But there's a lot of people who are first-time daycare providers. I mean, I can go on and on and on what 245 licenses. And so I'm a first-time person. I want to apply to become one of those entities that are covered the licenses. All of a sudden, I'm sorry, but 21 years ago, you did this. And as you remember, several years ago, you put a long list of crimes in 245 that say if you can be banned. So all of a sudden, to have something come out, which someone does not expect to happen, and these background checks are done on hundreds of thousands of people over a period of time, I think there's a privacy interest for the applicant. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would encourage you to delete applying to the applicant, which is something that's new that has not been done before.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Neumeister on the A2 amendment? All right. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any other testimony on House File 1466 as amended? Any questions by committee members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of Mr. Kemberling's testimony, I'm wondering, Ms. Byer-Kropinski, can you have one of the genius grammarians from your office testify as to why they changed that, why they wanted that changed to R instead of is?
Ms. Byer-Kropinski.
Are they here?
Mr. Chair and members, one of my staff is here.
Is it the smart one who wanted to change, Ms. Byer-Kropinski?
Ms. Byer-Kropinski.
Perhaps. Perhaps she might have corrected my testimony to make sure I was using the plural this evening.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
I'm Stacey Christensen. I work in the Information Policy Analysis Division with Lori and members, Representative Lesh. Data, as it is generally described in the Act, are plural. And so using data are as the plural form as opposed to data is. A data element would be a singular.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, and I'm not going to take much
time. And we're glad that Representative Sandra Erickson isn't here tonight because she probably have to weigh in on this as well. So
I'll keep it short. But I had always thought, and my only concern is, you know, is this, are we going to look at changing this in every bill that goes through that refers to this term? But isn't it, I thought it was a collective noun, like money or water. If we have the word money in a bill, we don't say are, we say is, or the lakes in Minnesota, it's water. Or do we say waters now? I mean, is that operate the same way?
Ms. Christensen.
I think it's similar to information. We say information is, but we're saying data are, because we discuss different data elements.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other burning questions on this particular bill?
It was burning, too, by the way.
I can tell. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Scott, I don't know if you want to technically lay this over on the table at this point and whether or not we're going to amend. I'm unclear of the process that's been chosen for tonight, but I think what we'll do is we'll lay your bill on the table. At this point, we'll continue to work through. It's my understanding you have a bill up in Commerce as well. We'll continue to work through the bills on the agenda, and hopefully by the time you get back, we know exactly what we're going to do for process tonight.
Sounds good.
All right. And so House File 1466 laid on the table. The next item on the agenda is House File 1130, Representative Nornes. And members, there's a DE2 delete everything amendment in your packet. So Representative Nornes, I will move House File 1130 for consideration by the subcommittee. And if you would like, would be happy to move the DE2 amendment if that's...
I think we'd like to do that right away to get it to the form we'd like.
All right, members, we'd like to adopt the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Welcome to the committee, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll give you a quick overview. First of all, House File 1130 limits the liability exposure for non-public colleges and universities. Data that they're required to share with the Office of Higher Education is breached, improperly disclosed, or misused by the Office of Higher Education, or by individuals or entities provided access to the data by the Office of Higher Education. This delete all amendment that we've adopted addresses the concerns that have been raised since the bill was first introduced. Madam Chair, I'll just give you a little further information about this bill. Under current Minnesota law, all colleges and universities are required to share with the Office of Higher Education enrollment and financial aid data for the students who are enrolled in that institution. Currently, colleges are operating under the data sharing agreements that were entered into in the mid-1990s, which identify which data is to be shared, describes the scope for the use of that data, and limits the use of the data solely by the office. The Office of Higher Education is asking the colleges now to enter into new data sharing agreements that will allow the office to combine the enrollment data the colleges provide with K-12 student record data currently collected by the Department of Education. This would create a new education database that the agencies can use for research, for evaluation, and for policy analysis. This new framework for the use of the data increases the risk of misuse or improper disclosure of that data given the increased number of agencies and individuals who will have access to the data. The colleges are very concerned about the increased risk that they're asked to shoulder under this new agreement. The colleges are now being asked to provide the data to the Office of Higher Education, which is a state agency, that the colleges have oversight committees with and strong connections to, and then to allow the Office of Higher Education to make the data accessible to other state agencies for which the colleges have no control, no oversight, and no direct relationship with. Under this bill, the private colleges or universities that share student data with the Office of Higher Education would not be liable for damages incurred by an individual through any misuse, unlawful access of the data, or improper data disclosure that results from the actions of the office or individuals or entities that the office grants access to the data. And that's the detail. And we have with me tonight representatives from the Minnesota Private College Council, and they're here to provide answers to questions if you have some.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to add any additional testimony to Representative Nornes's explanation of the bill, and then we'll stand for questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott McMahon, the Director of Government and Community Affairs of Minnesota Private College Council. We represent the 17 private nonprofit, liberal arts colleges in the state, enrolling about 45,000 undergraduate students per year, 15,000 graduate students. And given the fact that Representative Nornes read my comments to him perfectly, I have nothing to add into what he had provided for you this evening, but I will stand for any questions. And we do have Phyllis Karasov, our legal expert on data issues, with us as well for any questions members might have.
Thank you for your brevity. Are there any questions at this time of the bill author or the testifiers? I have a couple of them. This whole thing concerns me, so I am getting mixed feedback from different people that are coming in for data issues around this longitudinal study and the access to Social Security numbers, workforce data. And so that's not your end of this, but you feed this system. And so is this truly an opt-in? In other words, when your students register, do you tell them if you don't opt out of data sharing by participating in this, we're going to cough up your Social Security number to an agency that's going to do a longitudinal study that's also going to get access to your employment records and all kinds of good stuff? I mean, to what degree is there disclosure about what failure to opt out means relative to their record sharing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to the best of my understanding, it is, from our campus standpoint, a opt-out scenario. We do are required on an annual basis to provide information to the students, informing them as to kind of what's going on, and giving them the opportunity to opt out. This is all regulated by FERPA. We are in discussions now as to moving forward, if things move forward with this state longitudinal data system, what sort of disclosure we do need to provide for students. Right now, there's no requirement that the disclosure be made, but we probably believe it's in the best interest for us to be forthright with the students as to how the data will be used. At this point, I will turn it over to Phyllis Karasov, who can better describe with better legal knowledge.
Because kind of let them know what opt-in means. That doesn't give me a whole lot of warm fuzzies. If you have a disclosure statement with you that you provide to students, I look at how we're, every single year people come in and they want access to this or that to put it together to track kids from preschool all the way through, you know, after they graduate from college. And my guess is that the vast majority of these students, when they register for college, have no clue on the day they're there with their parents and looking at their dorm room and doing, you know, 14 other things, including checking out members of the opposite sex. They're really not, you know, attuned to whether I check this box or not, whether my information is going to become part of some big longitudinal study that's going to drive educational policy for the state or whatever. So that's my concern, that we're just, so help me out here. How much do you inform students before they make this really important decision whether or not government's going to track them and their income and achievements, et cetera?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Phyllis Karasov. I'm an attorney with Moore, Costello, and Hart. The opt-out phrase is it refers to what's called directory information, which is described in the federal statute that is responsible for protecting the privacy and confidentiality of student education records. And that opt-out provision applies only to what's called directory information, which is the name and address of the student, what their major is, what their height and weight is if there's athletic participation. So the opt-out part of directory information does not apply to Social Security number, which you've suggested, and other items. It's really more of the, quote, public information that used to be disclosed in a directory. In the days when colleges had a directory, and if you were looking up another student, you just, you know, it was like the yellow pages of your school. And the students have the right to opt out and say, I don't want that information disclosed about me. But that's not, a lot of the information here is not covered by that. Under state law, there is a lot of enrollment and financial aid and other information that is required to be disclosed to the Office of Higher Education. And the institution has no choice. It has to provide that information. And a student does not have the right to opt out of some of that information. The name, the address, they can opt out of that. We have been discussing whether the in the annual notification that is required under federal law of this opt-out provision for directory information, although we're not required to do it, we're discussing and considering whether we should inform students that if they opt out of directory information, then that also would not be shared with OHE as a part of the SLEDS program. But at this time, it's not part of the annual notification.
All right. Are there any questions by committee members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a few of the same black helicopter concerns as you do with this data. But it was explained to me by...
Representative Lesh, my helicopters are pink.
We just disagree on who the pilot is.
Okay.
I was told by Mr. Cirkvenik et al. When they came in my office that this data is all, sorry, are all laundered. when it comes through the longitudinal study anyway, is that true? That's not related to any opt-in or opt-out discussion, even if a student's Social Security number, for example, is included in the pool. Ultimately, it's not part of any kind of longitudinal study. You can't go 15 years from now and pull an individual student out of that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh.
Mr. McMahon.
I will try and answer your question the best of my ability. If I start to stray, the Office of Higher Education is here and can probably answer that much better than I can. Our understanding is that the data elements will go in specifically connected to each student. They'll be linked up. So if, you know, Joe Smith went to high school X and then enrolled in, you know, St. Thomas University, those data points will be linked up. It'll be eventually scrubbed of the identifiers, which would include Social Security number and such. When it's put into the data system that's then accessible by the collection of agencies and the researchers who would be granted access to it. There are a lot of kind of murky things going on with this. What gets tricky from our standpoint is the Office of Higher Education will be feeding data into the system. Department of Education will be feeding data into the system. Eventually, there's the possibility that the Department of Employment and Economic Development would be able to feed data into the system. It will be de-identified at that point, but each one of those agencies is going to retain the ability to re-identify data. And there will be some, and this is where it gets far beyond my technical capacities, there will be some information remaining in there so that in the next year, when the data is filtered in, that the student from last year can be connected to the student from the current year, assuming that it's the same student.
Well, and Representative Lesh, if you come from a small town with a limited number of graduates and there were two of you that went into social studies, and one of you went to a public school, and one of you went to a private school. I mean, it doesn't take very long when you start slicing and dicing data that you can identify based on characteristics, and the de-identifying is just kind of a joke for researchers.
That's probably true.
So, Representative Lesh.
In a small town, they already know all that stuff about you anyway, don't they, Madam Chair?
I'm not sure.
That's part of the bummer. Thank you, though.
All right. Would anybody like to testify on House File 1130 as amended? Mr. Neumeister, state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. First of all, I'd like to thank the folks for narrowing down their bill. It's a concern in the other body. I work with folks over there, so it only applies to non-public institutions. It narrows it down. Secondly, I do have some concerns about the due diligence of the private entities. When, you know, it's basically, I look at this like they're shirking the responsibility. And so what kind of due diligence do they offer? It's just the kind of thing in my gut. You know, they want immunity or whatever, but somehow they could be a culprit. They didn't do their due diligence, you know, of the data and sharing with whatever the data may be. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's my concern.
Well, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Thank you. Is anybody else in the audience that would like to testify in support or opposition to House File 1130 as amended? Any additional questions by the committee? All right. In discussions with Committee Administrator Mr. Reynolds, what we're going to do as a procedure tonight is we will take votes on bills as far as moving them to the Civil Law Committee, and then a determination will be made whether they move individually out of Civil Law or in an omnibus bill form before committee on Thursday. So if there's no questions on House File 1130 as amended, I would move a recommendation that this pass and be referred to the Civil Law Committee as a whole. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. No. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Nornes. The next item on the agenda, I guess, Representative Paymar has a bill up in taxes, I understand, and would like to be moved forward on the agenda. So if we can go to, I'm sorry, Representative Simon.
Might I recommend, since we're taking specific votes on bills, we haven't done it yet, right, on the Scott vehicle bill?
Representative Simon, we have not. I thought I'd wait till she get back till committee. I don't. I told her we'd wait till she got back to figure out what we're doing here. So, Representative Paymar, I'd be happy to move House File 1370 considered by the committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are two amendments that you should have. One is the A3 amendment, and then one is the A2 amendment. I guess I'd need staff to sort of help me out here to get this
And Representative Paymar, I have House File 1370. I have the A2 amendment and the A3 amendment. And Mr. Gehring, it looks like we need to do the A2 amendment. So would you like to explain to the committee what that amendment is doing? Is it basically to get the bill in the shape you want to discuss?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Members, in order to get the bill in the shape that Representative Paymar would like to discuss, I'd like to adopt the A2 amendment to House File 1370. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted.
Amen.
And then
Chair,
the A3 amendment.
The A3 is the same.
All right. Members, the A3 amendment also to get the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss it. So I'd move the A3 amendment to House File 1370. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, just in a nutshell, the motivation I have with me, Tara Patet from the City Attorney's Office in St. Paul, can talk about this in more detail. But the idea here is that in domestic violence cases, the probation department, by enacting this bill and making these changes to Section 1384 would be allowed to gather information about risky domestic violence offenders. So it would allow the probation department access from law enforcement, police reports, investigative reports, and with the amendment that you just passed, it would be domestic violence related crimes that the probation department would then have as a summary document that they would be able to use. This comes out of a project that actually the legislature funded in St. Paul called the Blueprint for Safety, and I'm going to turn this over, if I may, to Ms. Pettette to offer a brief explanation of the intent.
Great. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Tara Pettette. I've been a prosecutor for the city of St. Paul for the past 16 years. A lot of that time has been in the area of domestic violence. As Representative Paymar pointed out, the city of St. Paul has been working hard to implement the Blueprint for Safety, which is a comprehensive, collaborative approach to combating domestic violence in our community. One of the main principles that the Blueprint teaches us is that if we are able to look at each act of domestic violence in context, we can better assess the risk that a particular offender poses to the to victims and to the public. But in trying to gather the information that's necessary to do that, we as criminal justice practitioners have encountered a couple of main roadblocks. One is that the key partners in the criminal justice system are not able to share all of the necessary information with each other. These amendments would allow probation, police, and prosecution to share pertinent information just to perform their basic functions. A second roadblock is that while much of the information that we need to assess risk can be found in various databases currently, it's not summarized anywhere with regard to specifics such as the type of violence that an offender has used and to whom his violence has been directed. So when an individual is arrested on a new offense, we're not able to connect all those dots in the very short period of time that we have between arrest and having to make a charging decision or a pretrial release decision. It's important to note that these bills do not mandate the release of any information. We are not asking probation or the police department to simply open up their drawer and allow people to have unfettered access to data. And it does not change the current classification of any data. It simply allows us to have available critical information so that we can more appropriately and accurately respond to domestic violence when it occurs. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I have also with me Mr. Chris Crutchfield from the Community Corrections Department of Ramsey County. Do you have any specific questions?
Any questions on the bill as amended? I do have a couple. I think this is a pretty wide expansion of access to information. Can you tell me what a court services department is? Is that a public entity, a private entity? Is it?
Madam Chair, I'm not positive, but I think that's under that's the language in 1382. Court Services Department. Yeah, the definition. It's in, I don't know, but it's in statute.
I guess I mean, are any of these private entities or nonprofits, or are these all state or court?
They're all, Madam Chair, they're all state, county, public entities. That's the current language in Subdivision 1 under definitions. I suspect that going back and the different county definitions for what corrections or probation was called.
And if I might, so when it says an agency performing pretrial release supervision or studies for criminal justice purposes, only the aforementioned groups could use this for studies. In other words, you couldn't have the University of Minnesota coming in for some type of criminal justice study or...
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yes, this is limited to probationary agencies.
All right. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 1370 as amended? Any questions by committee members? All right. Members, what we can do here now is then I would move that House File 1370 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. You're on your way back to civil, and we'll communicate with you as far as whether there's going to be an omnibus bill or move you separate, but the intent would not be to take additional testimony on these bills on Thursday, but rather it be more of a procedural move to move them.
I just wanted to tell you, though, that we may have a small amendment. We're trying to work out some of these issues here, if that, just so you know that.
I appreciate that, Representative Paymar. And if you would keep Representative Scott in the loop on that in case there's all you need to put into an omnibus bill, we would appreciate that.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Beard, are you still here? Certainly. Representative Simon, would you take the gavel while we do my bill unless Representative Beard is just in the hallway? No. Nope. Okay. He's in another committee.
Representative Holberg, House File 601.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a pretty basic issue. Over the years, we've struggled with what information is public when. It kind of all got wrapped up into the eminent domain stuff. And over the years, I think this issue in one form or another ends up before the Data Practices Committee. And the changes made in 601 are really quite simple, in that it allows discretion by the public authority to provide appraisal data if they so choose, and it would help facilitate, say, in the case of a willing seller or trying to come to some type of negotiated settlement for a sale without going through an eminent domain or a condemnation process. This might help in that process and save the taxpayers money in the long run. I have with me today from Dakota County Commissioner Nancy Showalter, who would also like to testify to the bill.
Commissioner, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Dakota County Commissioner Nancy Showalter. I chair our legislative committee, and I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee on Dakota County's proposed amendment to the Data Practices Act that would allow public agencies to voluntarily share a government-prepared real estate appraisal with a landowner prior to signing a binding purchase agreement. Currently, under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, real estate appraisals prepared by or on behalf of public agencies are classified as confidential data. This means that a public agency is prohibited from sharing such an appraisal, including the opinion of value, with anyone outside of the agency, not even if the private landowner who is voluntarily interested in selling either their land in fee title or a conservation easement on their land to the government. Dakota County has an active program to acquire conservation easements from private landowners in order to permanently protect important farmland, natural areas, and buffer corridors along rivers and streams. These easements are acquired only by voluntary sale to the county. Many landowners have made partial land value donations of their property as part of the competitive project selection process and to take advantage of tax law provisions that make these donations a qualified charitable contribution. Funding for these land protection efforts has come from a $20 million voter-approved bond issue in 2002. To date, the county has protected nearly 7,300 acres. Real estate negotiation is a difficult process, especially in a dynamic market like we have today. Dakota County has a very good track record working with landowners. The county hires qualified professional appraisers to independently determine an opinion of fair market value. However, not allowing public entities to share its appraisal with a willing landowner interested in selling an easement or fee title before signing a legally binding purchase agreement creates an unnecessary and burdensome trust issue. Understandably, landowners wonder if the public entity is negotiating in good faith, based on a professional and independent appraisal, when this critical information cannot be discussed with them until after the agreement is signed. We believe that agencies should have the authority to share their appraisal information in circumstances where it would be helpful, and that they should retain the authority to keep it confidential when that approach would be helpful or essential. In other words, when that approach would this proposed amendment would provide important and valuable flexibility in working fairly and transparently with willing landowners for projects that can provide a variety of public benefits. I want to thank you for consideration of this bill, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any member questions on House File 601?
Mr. Chair, this has passed Holbert? The House, I think, last year. I don't know if Mr. Tilley's here, but yeah, we passed it. Okay, I guess MnDOT, I don't know if you're going to testify. I've just been informed that MnDOT may have some issues. If they want to briefly testify, it certainly will work with them before Thursday to clarify their concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Radin, MnDOT Government Affairs. Our only concern is that the bill as drafted talks about the information becoming public determined by a majority vote of the governing body, and for a state agency, we're not sure who that governing body would be. Would that be the legislature? So we have no objections or concerns with the bill other than maybe just to clarify the process that we would follow for a state agency.
Representative Holbert, any ideas? Well, I don't know if that's something we could clear up tonight, or would you be amenable to?
I don't want to waste the committee's time tonight, and there's some scratch on here that may be at the discretion of the commissioner, so we'll look at getting some language before Thursday to address that concern.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, but that seems pretty easily fixable. Representative Blesch.
Thank you, Representative Holbert. Did you look at the letter that we had in our packet from this Jim Stengrim of Park Rapids and his concerns about the bill?
Mr. Chair, I did see that letter. I don't have it in front of me. If there were any particulars, I first read it, I didn't understand the concern.
Okay. Well, that would have been my question.
Mr. Tilley's at the ready. I had sent this to him as well. So, I just didn't understand the concern about unfair treatment of social, religion, or sexual classes. I think that in this particular situation, it doesn't make any sense if you have a willing seller or a semi-willing seller. Why should you have to have two appraisals done if you're trying to accomplish a land sale or an easement purchase, or whatever the need may be? To be able to have that appraisal, and certainly it doesn't preclude an individual landowner for getting their own appraisal as well. But for the public entity to share what they have as a starting point for negotiation, the taxpayers have already paid for the appraisal done by the public entity, it just makes no sense to me. And I think how we got to this point where they're not able to share it was just a series of different changes in law over the years in this area, and I think this was an unintended consequence that makes this non-public data until the point of sale.
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, and that was my question. The second paragraph of his letter states, the purpose of the statute was to protect real property owners from government entities generating appraisals and using them to drive down the value of property they're interested in purchasing. Now, are these appraisals ever recorded anywhere in that they become an official record, which could drive down general prices of properties? Or is he just talking about in an individual negotiation you could start out by lowballing with your own appraisal? Is it the former or the latter, that insofar as you're able to extrapolate from the letter, which is it? Sorry, maybe.
I don't want to try and ascertain Mr. Stengroom's intent here. I mean, I don't know if the commissioner would like to comment. I mean, the reality is that county government public entities term valuation for taxation purposes and all kinds of things. They get an independent appraisal. It doesn't preclude the landowner from getting their own. And, of course, with the changes to eminent domain law, et cetera, that have occurred in the legislature over the last 3 or 4 years, which I think Representative Simon spent a lot of time on that particular issue, you can't force somebody to sell property unless it meets a pretty high standard now in the state of Minnesota, and then that gets into a whole other process with eminent domain, et cetera. So, I mean, I don't think you're going to be using this process of early disclosure under an adversarial type of property acquisition anyway.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Commissioner.
Our program that is strictly voluntary, property owners submit an application and their applications are scored because we don't have as much money as we have willing participants. And at this point, once the purchase agreement is signed, then the information is public and we can disclose it to the willing seller. But until that time of the signing of the purchase agreement, we're not able to disclose that information.
Any other member questions or comments? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 601? Okay. Seeing nobody, I'll then, I don't know if it's been moved yet, but I don't believe it has. I'll move that House File 601 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the full Civil Law Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Representative Beard, welcome to the committee. What we're
Madam
going
Chair.
To do is consider your bill and then have a motion to move it to the full Civil Law Committee. And so I will move recommendation or move House File
1060
for consideration by the Data Practices Subcommittee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1060 is one of the technical bills that comes from MnDOT. As Chair of the Transportation Committee, I receive several of these bills during the year, and I am carrying this one, mostly because it deals with two issues that I've helped author over the past several years. Design-build is a concept that has been in practice over at MnDOT for about a decade now, with actually a high degree of success. But as the design-build experience has unfolded, it's become clear to the commissioner that there are some adjustments that need to be made in how we handle some of the proprietary information that comes from the contractors that form partnerships and that apply their expertise to projects that benefit the department and, by extension, then the taxpayers and citizens of this state. So that's mostly what you're going to find on page 1 and 2 of the bill, going on to page 3, and then there's some other technical data, privacy data on page 3 with the Adopt the Highway program, and then a one that perhaps some of you heard something about on talk radio and in the blogosphere, the mileage-based user fee data, which is something many of us have been working on for, some of us have been working on for about another 8 or 10 years now. Members, to explain in a little more detail and to stand for technical question, I have one of the experts from MnDOT here to testify about the bill. Mr. Peter Zudica is with us. Madam Chair, if I could introduce him to the committee and let him explain a little more, we'd
I think we'd be well served.
All right. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Zuniga, Z-U-N-I-G-A. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Transportation, primarily focusing on data practices issues. If you look in Section 2, this section addresses the data that's collected as part of our design-build process. I think it's important to note that this legislation isn't changing how we let design-build process or design-build projects. It makes no changes in the procurement process. And what we found over the last year and a half, is that the current statute doesn't address all of the data that's gathered as part of the design-build process. So our intent with this is to take into account all of that data and determine at what point in the bidding process it becomes public, with the goal at the end that all that data becomes public with the exception of trade secret data, as it's classified in Chapter 13.37. If you look at
I'm sorry, if I might, there is an A2 amendment, and Representative Beard, is that your amendment in order to get
Is that the bill? One, Madam Chair, that strikes subdivision or Section 1 on page 1?
It deletes Section 1 and then it adds some. And so if Paige could get a copy to Representative Beard, that would be great.
One would just hand it to me, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Is this your amendment, Representative Beard?
Well, Madam Chair, I have an A2 amendment.
All right.
That has lines 1.1 to 1.11. Is that the one you're looking at? Yes. That would be our amendment, and I'd, if someone could offer that, I'd speak to it. And
all right. Members, I'd like to move the A2 amendment to get Representative Beard's bill in the shape in which you'd like to discuss it. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted, or passes, amendment's adopted. Representative Beard, I'm sorry for that. Hopefully now it's the way that you would like it.
And there may be a couple more, Madam Chair, or certainly at the same when it reaches the full committee, we may have a couple more amendments. Okay. Thank you for reminding me there was an author's amendment. So perhaps if I could have Mr. Zuniga continue.
All right, and sir, I'm sorry for the interruption, but if you'd like to continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 3 discusses our Adopt a Highway program. The Adopt a Highway program is going on its 21st year of existence here in Minnesota, and we have approximately 45,000 volunteers. These volunteers consist of businesses, church organizations, family members. So what we're looking to do is to protect the home contact information of those volunteers. I'm offering these volunteers some degree of protection that their home contact information isn't going to be distributed. We think we'll encourage them to volunteer. And what we found out is last year we did receive a couple of data practices requests for this information. A lot of the volunteers expressed some discomfort with MnDOT distributing their home contact information. Fortunately for us, the requesters were very aware of that issue and was willing to work with us to achieve what he wanted to achieve, which was throw a thank you barbecue for the volunteers. Section 4 discusses our mileage-based user fee. In 2007, the legislature granted MnDOT the authority and appropriated money for us to conduct a test pilot program, which is a mileage-based user fee tax program. We knew that with the presumption that everything's public, unless there's a law that classified it as something that's not public, we knew that this data would most likely be public. So we did approach the Department of Administration. We did get a temporary classification to make certain data about the program not public. And really what this section does is it codifies it. Because if it doesn't, the temporary classification will expire on August 1st, 2013. Section 5 is actually not in the Data Practices Act. It's in Chapter 169, which governs accident reports that are maintained by the Department of Public Safety. Right now, we currently have authority to access those accident reports for a limited purpose, which is accident analysis. we would like an additional authorization for that access, which is for determining damage to state-owned infrastructure, which is guardrails, light posts, bridge columns, so that we can, one, determine the damage, and two, so we can seek restitution from the responsible party. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, members. Are there any questions for Representative Beard or his testifier? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, sir. How you just discussed seeking restitution for damages. How do you currently ask for restitution for damages in a, say, single car accident?
Representative Beard.
Well, Madam Chair, let me just share with everybody my experience when my son wrapped my pickup truck around a light post. And my insurance agent recommended that I call MnDOT and report the incident because he drove the truck home, cockeyed, mind you. Nobody saw him knock the light post down. I actually called six different numbers in the State Patrol trying to find somebody to report the accident to because my insurance company was willing to pay for a $2,500 light post. Statute of limitations has expired, so I can tell you this story. So it's harder than it looks, so I think that having them have the ability to track it down probably could garner some insurance money to put $2,500 light posts back up. But perhaps the testifier does have something more serious to say about the issue, Madam Chair.
Mr. Zeninga, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, right now I do believe there is actually a requirement in Chapter 169 that requires you to notify the owner of the property. Whether people actually know about that requirement is another matter, whether they can report it to MnDOT. Currently, right now, if there is an accident on an interstate or a trunk highway, a state trooper will put a yellow tag on the damaged infrastructure. And our maintenance crews will go out there and find the yellow tag and be able to ask the Department of Public Safety for that particular accident report. There are occasions where that yellow tag will blow off, or a local law enforcement agency has responded to an accident, and they don't necessarily inform MnDOT that there is damage to state-owned infrastructure. What this access will do is the Department of Public Safety maintains a database of all accident reports in the state. So what this would do, it would allow certain MnDOT employees to search that database to determine if there is damage to state-owned infrastructure to be able to access that particular accident report.
Representative Lesh?
I'm trying to think of what my next question would be, Chair.
We can go to Representative Simon if you'd like to ponder
that.
Yeah,
let me think about that.
Then. Okay. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a procedural question. Representative Beard, is this going to go to your committee or has it been there already?
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, no, it's starting here. I assume that we're going to be asking for it in Transportation Committee, so it'll come there as well.
So,
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. So is this then simply so that you don't have to have your crews roll up and down the road looking for a yellow tag? They can get the specific location from the report and go directly there?
Madam Chair, members of the
Mr.
committee.
Mr. Zeninga.
In one way, yes. You know, the way it had worked in the past was that we would send one of our maintenance guys physically over to the Department of Public Safety and ask for the accident reports. So it would prevent our maintenance guys from driving up and down freeways to notice damage to the infrastructure. But it would also eliminate the need for us to send someone over to the Department of Public Safety.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, from my other job, I read police reports, accident reports all day long. And it really depends on, doesn't it, the diligence of the State Patrol or law enforcement agency specifically labeling exactly where it is, not just at the interchange of Dale and 94. And if you have to go examine every single piece of public infrastructure there, it may be kind of difficult. So, well, I think I answered my own question, Madam Chair. This is just going to simply make it a little bit easier for you, not conclusive. Is that right?
That's correct.
Mr. Zuniga.
Okay.
Well, I'm a little confused. Why don't you have access to these already?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do have access to certain accident reports as a party to the accident. We also have access to all accident reports only for the purpose of accident analysis. So if we accessed all the reports for determining damage to the infrastructure, we think that's outside of the scope of the authority that's in 169.
So why can't you just say we see a light pole on 35, blah, 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 such and such location, and then go to that jurisdiction and look for an accident report relative to that location, and this broad access to every single record in the state? I'm not understanding this. I mean, if you look at the language, for many, many purposes, this information's public. It's also available to somebody who incurs a loss by virtue of the accident. I would assume that MnDOT's incurred a loss. So, I mean, I'm hearing you say you just want blanket access to every single gall darn accident report across the state to make it easier for you, or why? I'm not understanding.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, not only is it really what it would be easier for us, but it also alleviates some staffing concerns of the Department of Public Safety. Right now, if we're looking for an accident report only for the purposes of determining damage to the infrastructure, we wouldn't have access to those other reports, and the Department of Public Safety would actually have to separate the accident reports that we don't have access to. So really what the legislation intends is to sort of alleviate some of the staffing issues at Department of Public Safety, and also create a more efficient process for MnDOT.
Representative Beard, did you want to comment?
I do, Madam Chair. At line 3.26, it says that this will be available for the purpose of seeking restitution for damages. And so I can't imagine that they're going to have somebody browsing through accident reports looking for somebody who hit a light standard or a stop sign. But when they find damages to state-owned infrastructure, they would have access to them for purposes of finding out, if possible, who actually knocked down that light pole.
Well, and Representative Beard, if you look farther down in the bill and look under subdivision 13 under 1, you can see people that suffer property loss have access to these accident reports.
Okay.
So I hear your testifier saying, well, we don't want to go site-specific or damage item damage specific. We want access to all accident reports across the whole system because it'd be easier.
Right, Madam Chair. MnDOT does believe we have access to the reports under subdivision 1. The problem with that is simply a volume issue. We process approximately between 200 and 300 accidents a month. So if we requested 200 accident reports from the Department of Public Safety, I'm not sure that they have the staffing to deal with that. Also, there's a time frame involved. For the Department of Public Safety to search for 200, 300 accident reports, we need to get those accident reports so we can make repair any damage to the infrastructure for safety issues.
Well, what are you doing now?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, before we would send one of our maintenance engineers over to the Department of Public Safety, and they would look for accident reports that involved MnDOT infrastructure, which meant that they were going through all the accident reports. The Department of Public Safety determined that wasn't appropriate, so they essentially have cut off our access to all accident reports. We've met with the Department of Public Safety. We've tried to develop a process where, for those accidents that we can identify, whether it's by the yellow tag, whether it's a trooper coming into a MnDOT office saying, here's a damaged guardrail, for those accidents we can identify, we do routinely submit those to the Department of Public Safety and they do return those accident reports. But there is probably a 2 to 3 month lag in that. I don't know if we can necessarily afford to draw out that process, because in the meantime, a guardrail over a bridge can't get repaired because we haven't had any restitution to repair it.
Well, I haven't noticed MnDOT not repairing guardrails on bridges because I couldn't find the person that did it. They repair them right away because it's a safety issue. So, is anybody from the Department of Public Safety here? Are they supportive of this, or? Mr. Radin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know you're not from the Department of Public Safety, but you might have something to add, huh?
With the Department of Transportation Office of Government Affairs, I think the important point here, as Mr. Zuniga stated, there's been a change at Department of Public Safety. They are now telling us that we no longer have access to these accident reports. So that's why we have this legislation before you today. In the past, we were able to go and review all accident reports to make that determination about which ones involve damage to MnDOT-owned infrastructure. But I think they made the correct judgment at Department of Public Safety that the law does not technically allow that today. They are telling us they don't have the staff time to look at all accident reports and determine which ones involve damage to MnDOT-owned infrastructure. We're willing to do that. We just need the law changed so that we can have MnDOT staff review accident reports, determine which ones involve damage to MnDOT-owned infrastructure, and then seek restitution. Does that help answer your question?
Not really. Well, it answers my question, but I'm hesitant to provide this broad latitude of access.
Madam Chair,
for MnDOT.
I think if the law is not changed, we will only be able to seek restitution for those accidents where we have specific knowledge of we have been notified somehow, whether it's through that yellow tag process or some other process. But there are other accidents that DPS has records of that involve damage to MnDOT infrastructure, and they know who the driver of the vehicle was. But we no longer will be able to go after those restitution for those accidents.
Well, Mr. Radin, why would you not be able to go after the information on those under Subdivision 1?
Madam Chair, because somebody has to make the determination that it involves damage to MnDOT infrastructure. Somebody has to make that initial determination. And under the current law, MnDOT doesn't have the ability to look at all accident reports and make that determination.
But Mr. Radin, why can't MnDOT look at their equipment and their infrastructure and say this guardrail is damaged on the Lafayette Bridge and this occurred since the last inspection, which was 2 weeks ago, so I want to see the accident reports on the Lafayette Bridge for the last 2 weeks?
Well, Madam Chair, if we have a specific accident report number, we can do that, and we have been doing that and getting those records from Department of Public Safety. But to make a blanket request like that, the law currently does not allow us to review all accident reports for that 2 week period on the Lafayette Bridge. So Department of Public Safety would have to go through the records and make that determination. And they're telling us they don't have the staff time to be able to do that.
All right, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, trying to figure out how much of this is moot, because, first, maybe you can answer a question for me. What's the average time now it takes you to make a determination of the ownership of the property, if it's MnDOT or not, and secondarily, what the price tag is on that for repair or replacement? And then how long would it take you if you had this provision in that sped up the process?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Zuniga.
Members of the committee. Right now, I think we're looking at a 2 to 3 month time frame to get those accident reports that we do know about. As far as the price tag, I think I've seen only here in the metro area that we retrieve or we recover, I think, approximately $2 million from insurance companies to cover the replacement of our infrastructure.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
And to the first part of the question, how long would it take you then, and I presume it would be faster than 2 to 3 months, if you had this provision in place?
Right.
Mr. Zeninga.
Madam Chair, members, Department of Public Safety maintains all this information in an electronic database. So we would get remote access to that database. So a MnDOT employee can actually be sitting at their desk, access the database. I believe it's a web-based application, and we can have instantaneous access.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
And, Chair, and so did you have this instantaneous access before DPS yanked it? And how long was it taking for you to get the data and make the cost assessment at that time?
Mr. Zeninga.
Madam Chair, members, we do have electronic access only for the purpose of accident analysis. So our traffic engineers do have access right now. For our maintenance engineers, for the guys that are actually out there repairing the infrastructure, they do not have access to it. As far as the time frame that it takes, I'm unaware of that right now, and I can certainly follow up with you.
Right.
Okay. Well,
Representative Lesh,
the reason I'm asking is we're looking at a couple different areas here. What I think MnDOT's looking at is getting insurance companies to pony up, but I think at least in the metro area, we've got close to 50 or more than 50% of drivers uninsured. So you're talking about unrecoverable damages, unless you get them in the court case where they plead guilty to reckless driving or a DWI, in which case you want data for restitution to which you're entitled under victims' rights statutes, even as a state entity, at the time of the sentencing, because that's when the judge imposes the restitution. Or oftentimes they'll say, no, you got to pay restitution 90 days for the victim to submit an affidavit, and if so, then you got to do it then. But if you still don't get it that quickly, a lot of those accidents are resolved prior to that time. So I'm just wondering how much this provision will even change things. That's all, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against this bill as amended? Mr. Gemberling, Mr. Neumeister, you go on down and state your name for the record, please. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairman, Don Gemberling again. Again, speaking for the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. One of the really critical places where the public ought to be able to have access to data is when the government is making decisions about how to spend money. Okay? This is one of those situations where the government is making a decision about how to spend money by giving a contract to do a transportation project. When I looked at the language in Section 2, and I'd spent 40 years interpreting language, this is some of the most difficult language to interpret I have ever seen, okay? Because it has a series of conditions that determine how the data are classified and when it's classified, okay? And my basic concern is there just has to be a simpler way to draft this. I'm not disagreeing with the policy. There just got to be a simpler way to draft this. Because among other things, the conditions basically involve a series of decisions by the Commissioner of Transportation. How does the public know those decisions have been made? Okay? Are the data about the decisions public? You know, one of the truisms of dealing with the government is the government doesn't have to answer people's questions. They choose to, but they don't have to. So to be able to figure out what data I can get at a given point in time, I need to know where in the process of decision-making the commissioner has been. Okay? So there's got to be a simpler way to do this without affecting what you're trying to accomplish. Okay. On a more technical vein, I don't know who the members of the technical review committee that are referred to here are, if they're individuals or they're people or individuals or companies. But if they're individuals, then saying that data about them is protected non-public or non-public, that doesn't fit. Because for data to be protected non-public or not non-public, in the scheme of the Data Practices Act, it's got to be data that's not about individuals. Okay? That's basically what I have. The discussion about accident reports, I think you need to be aware that the accident reporting statute is a function of a requirement of federal law. As usual, the feds have said, if you're going to take our money, you got to do blah, blah. The purpose of having the accident reports filed by the people in accident under that law is to get people to tell the government very honestly why they had an accident. Okay? That's what those forms are for. And the rationale of providing the confidentiality is to encourage people to be honest. Okay. Now, there was some confusion about reports in a local police department. These are the forms you fill out when you have an accident. Okay. These are the reforms that Representative Beard's son would have to fill out if anybody at public safety ever was willing to answer the phone call. Okay. You know, routinely law enforcement people hand you the form when you've been in an accident. But it's a form. It's not what the cop is collecting when he or she says, okay, tell me what happened here, and they make a report back in the department. Okay. So, but one of the things I realized is if this language is adopted, public safety is going to have to redesign their form, because now there will be a different use of the data collected from people in accidents. They're going to have to be told, if you had an accident involving infrastructure, then public transportation is going to get that data. And then I start to wonder, is that going to start cutting away at frankness and disclosure of the data in the accident report? So, some things to think about.
Thank you, Mr. Gemberling. Any questions for Mr. Gemberling? All right, thank you. And Mr. Gemberling, I'm sure if you'd like some homework, Representative Beard might be open to suggestions on Section 2 of his bill. Mr. Neumeister, did you have something you wanted to add as well? Welcome to the committee, and we're going to try and finish up here pretty quick because the regular committee starts
at 8. Madam Chair, for the record, I echo Mr. Gemberling's comments on the section about Section 2. I think it's very important for accountability and transparency also where the public can follow. Number two, in regards to the comments about the language of the accident reports, I think it should be deleted. I think there's some privacy. The legislature made a policy for privacy, and to all of a sudden for efficiency purposes to do away with that, it's a point. Now, the thing that was kind of interesting is the part of the mileage revenue project. The way the language is now proposed leads to several problems. One, a low standard of how law enforcement could get access to the data that is being collected. What's going to happen is a GPS is going to be put on the revenue mileage project, and wherever you go, it's going to say here, there, where, everywhere. Law enforcement would like to get easy access to that kind of data. They do it on cell phones. They do it on other kinds of things. One of the things that I like to see done, because you are now putting it into law, is something that's very similar to what we have done in other statutes. It should basically say, and I'm taking this from the electronic prescription monitoring program that the Board of Pharmacy has and other kinds of things, that in order to get access to that, it should be through acting pursuant to a valid search warrant, which is a specific kind of court order, not a general court order, which, you know, to compel disclosure or whatever. So I would like to see that. One of the other things that I have a concern about the language, in my judgment, as proposed, does not allow the public any oversight, accountability, or transparency to see if the results of the project are correct after this study is done. Field data and vehicle ID are broad categories that can be used to shield data from the public that should be public. For example, what are the kind of cars that are being as used as part of the study? Where does the general nature of the people live? Let's say, for example, where they have to go 40 miles, 50 miles, 60 miles. What general area, so you can see how the mileage is collected and some of the rationale why they're paying certain kinds of taxes could be because they haven't built a bridge in an area and they got to go up this way and that way. People want to see how you came to the results. One of the other kinds of things is what's the quality of the car that's being used? If the car has bad springs or whatever, or maybe the person's not taking the regular road that everybody believes should be taken and decides to, you know, take it slow and go down the country road. Again, some aspects of the study is to get new revenue. And the other kinds of things, and what are the general circumstances, environment, and situation of the participants? There needs to be fleshing out of what should be public and what should be private. Remember, this is a $5 million study that you did in 2007. So at the end of the day, when the report comes out, I just don't want to rely on what they think summary data is. The public needs the accountability and transparency to see how this project is done, particularly whoever's at the legislature at this time, whether or not you want to go to do it a mandatory kind of thing. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are my 2 points. I think an amendment, as I talked to you before about it's on the electronic monitoring prescription process, and that there needs to be some more release of what kind of should be public. I've shared those concerns with Representative Beard, and he has said since it's taken a detour towards the transportation to include that as part of, you know, to work on that. And I know that by the testimony here today, at least on this particular bill, there are some points made to you that I know that you have an interest when this bill comes your way again, whether on the floor or in some other vein. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? All right, Representative Beard, I have a A2 amendment. I'm not going to move it for time's sake. I think there's some room for improvement around this mileage study issues, in fact, a number of issues with the bill. I think that, I don't know if you've already signed up participants in this study, but I think the participants in the study should be warned about how this information will be used, that law enforcement could access this information. They need to be fully informed before they choose to participate, what the information is, how it'll be used, how long it'll be held. You're going to destroy it in 2 years, 4 years, 10 years? You know, I just think we need a little more discussion around that as well. But that being said, are there any additional questions, comments, testimony? I'd move approval of the bill to the Civil Law Committee and hope that you take the time to work with some of the members of the public.
Will do.
And the committee that have expressed concerns. All those in favor of the motion say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. And then I guess we are supposed to take testimony on Representative Pepin's bill real quick. The bill isn't officially before. Oh, Representative Simon, okay. And members, I guess the bill isn't officially in front of the committee. It's in GovOps, but on page 3, section 6, there's data privacy issues in the bill. And Representative Simon, is it your intent to move this this portion of the bill as an amendment to an omnibus bill, or what were you trying to do today?
No. Madam Chair, I thought it was before this committee. Because we did hear it and thoroughly vet it in terms of the substance before, and it was moved to the Civil Law Committee. That was my understanding. Unless I just... didn't remember that correctly.
They're going to look it up online, okay. But in the meantime, let's discuss the bill and the issues before the subcommittee.
And Madam Chair, there really is only one issue. That's Section 6 of the bill. And with me here today is Mr. Goldsmith of the Campaign Finance Board. He can introduce himself and explain that one section. No need to vet all the rest of it.
I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'll state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. This is part of a larger bill that embodies the board's legislative recommendations for 2011. I want to tell you what the bill what this section does and what it doesn't do. First of all, Chapter 10A is the chapter that covers campaign finance disclosure. This section doesn't change the nature of the disclosure that's provided to the board and thus to the public. It doesn't change the timing of the disclosure that's provided, and it doesn't change what we do with the disclosure, which is we publish it on our website as soon as it comes in, the day after filing, actually. It really doesn't do anything to change the public's access to this data. What it does is help the board and treasurers prepare for mandatory electronic filing, which starts in 2012. Members may already know we have a campaign finance software application that you can use. And for those larger committees that for which the learning curve isn't too much, they like that program. They enter their data periodically, and when they click the button at filing time, it sends the data to us, but only the data that's disclosed to the campaign finance board. Members will understand that any transaction that you have that is $100 or less, whether it's a contribution or an expenditure, that's never reported to the board because the statute only requires itemization of amounts that are more than $100. And so on a report to the board, whether it's through our software or paper report, we have this column called unitemized transactions, and that's where we get those lump sums. As we move to electronic filing, many people will use the board software. They'll enter their data at their home. It's their data. And we don't get it. When they click the button, the data that's disclosable is transferred to the board, and then it's published. The other alternative that people will use is their own spreadsheet at their home, and they'll keep entering their data periodically, or maybe even a paper system. And once it's time to file, they'll send or fax that report to us, and we publish it. What we have recognized is that there's a fairly large group of filers who have internet, but don't have committees that are big enough to use our campaign finance application. They would benefit greatly from a way that they could periodically enter their transactions online so they don't have to do spreadsheets and so on. Just a fill-in-the-form type system where they would enter their data, and then, just like with the software that we provide, when it's time to do the report, the treasurer would click a button that says, file the report, and at that time, all of the disclosable data would be transferred to the board. So in other words, anything that's more than $100, we would get all that data. Anything that's less, we would get an unitemized total, exactly the same as is done now. The difficulty in creating that kind of an online system is that under the Data Practices Act, the data that the treasurer enters into that system, if the board is maintaining it, would be public from the time that it's entered. So there would be a continuous disclosure by a treasurer, including disclosure of all those minor transactions that would never become public in a regular reporting system. This change would allow the board to maintain an electronic system for these treasurers where they could enter data on a periodic basis. That data would be the treasurer's data. It would not be government data. And then when the time comes to file a report, it would click the button on the internet screen, and the data that's disclosable would come to us in the form of an electronic report. So it's no different than the data that comes from Campaign Finance Reporter or in a report that's faxed to us. The data is the same, and we would handle it the same once it gets to our office. This helps treasurers. It gives them an easy solution for electronic filing, which becomes mandatory. It helps the board because we don't have to do data entry, which introduces errors and delays in providing that data in a database format to the public. And it saves us, of course, the staff time of doing the data entry. Without this change, what's the alternative? Well, we simply won't do that system, and those filers will still file by paper. and we'll still get the reports in, we'll scan them, we'll data enter them, and handle them the way they are now. So it doesn't, this provision doesn't limit or change the scope of disclosure or the timing of disclosure, but it allows another tool that treasurers can use without the fear that their private data that they would normally keep at their home would become public.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
From me.
Representative Simon.
I'm wondering if Mr. Reynolds could tell us about the procedural status of the bill now that he's had a chance to check.
The bill was referred to the Civil Law Committee on floor action today, so it is in the committee. And so I don't know if we'll have to move it back through the Civil Law Committee. And so I don't know where else this bill would go, what your preference is with it. I do have a couple questions. So this system hasn't been developed or built yet, is that correct?
Madam Chair, no, this system hasn't been developed. We have the system that installs on your own home computer where the data stays on your computer. This would be a system where you could go on the internet and enter your data, and it would stay, it would be encrypted on a computer system maintained by the board. And because it's on a system maintained by a government entity, it would be public unless we have this provision.
And I understand that. My concerns, and this is probably about pink helicopters, my apologies here, but some of the most sensitive information in political campaigns, et cetera, would be just the kind of information that would be put into this system. Would this system have an audit trail? Where would the checks and balances be? How would we know that nobody else would have access to it? You know, I mean, I remember when the change was made that we're going to have, I think there's some kind of modifier, but that the reports be filed electronically by 2012 as practicable or something. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was told that there is an out, that you don't have to do it. You could continue to do paper. So I'm hearing you say that if we don't approve this, we wouldn't have, we wouldn't meet the mandate in the bill that was passed a couple years ago?
No, Madam Chair. There are several methods for electronic filing, including the application that we already provide. And commercial vendors are working on applications for the largest committees, the state party units and governor's committees and so on. This would be an application for that in-between size committee. There is an out, but the treasurer, the committee, has to request a waiver, and we're developing a process for that. And the waiver would be granted for good cause, and good cause wouldn't be simply, I don't want to do it, but it could be that my committee is too small to warrant the learning curve for the application that's currently available. It might be that my treasurer has never used a computer, things like that. But for most committees, we would expect them to be filing electronically beginning in 2012. This would just provide one additional option for those committees who will be filing electronically. It's an option that will be much simpler than the software product that we already provide. With respect to the privacy, first of all, let me address the data that will be going into this. The data that will be going into this will become public. Most of it will become public anyway, because any transaction that is more than $100 will become public. That's what you file already. So the only data that would go into this system that wouldn't become public would be those transactions, those donations of $100 or less, and those expenditures of $100 or less. This system wouldn't track other kinds of strategies or content or contact or volunteer lists or anything like that. It's strictly a financial reporting system. So yes, there would be some transactions in it that would not ever be disclosed under our current system and should not be disclosed under this system. That's the board's intention, and in fact the statute, as you might note, precludes the board from having access to this data as well as the public. This data would be encrypted. The users would create their own passwords. The board would be able to provide a password reset but would not be able to access the data. Sometimes for diagnostic reasons, treasurers want us to help them with their data, and so with written consent, they could consent to the board having access to this data. But it would be treasurer's data. There would be, I think, we would not intend to keep any more records than a treasurer would keep entering it into a spreadsheet in their home.
Right, thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, when are you going to get a version of that campaign finance software that works on my Mac?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, we do have a number of Mac users who are using the software successfully, but let me tell you just a bit about that. The cost of developing what would be called a native Macintosh version is prohibitive. We do all of the development in-house with existing staff. When this was originally developed, it cost us only $85,000. When it was redeveloped in 2000, it cost $250,000 to bring it up to date with then current technology. We do have a Mac in the office now. We've tested it in a Mac using what's called Parallels, but it has to use some sort of a Windows emulation program. We do provide support for that, though, so if your treasurer or yourself want to call our tech support staff, we can help you with that.
Thank you.
And members, we're 5 minutes over our time here, and so Representative Mr. Neumeister, if you'd like to briefly provide comment.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think this section needs to go out. What I have a concern about, and what it's different, it allows private entities and persons to keep data on a government system. It's basically non-government data. I've not seen something like that before. And so to provide a service for a non-government entity, I have a concern about. Concern you raised, Madam Chair, I also. A public system for private interest, it is very unique. Will they pay for the service to the government? More questions need to be asked. The bottom line is, I think it's nose under the camel's tent, something that's very different, and I think there can be other alternatives developed. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you, and I'm sure Representative Scott will share, or Representative Simon will share your concerns with Representative Pepin. And members, is there any additional testimony from the public on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Simon will renew his motion that House File 1533 be recommended to pass and refer to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Thank you very much. We need to step back to House File 1466. Unfortunately, Representative Scott must still be having fun in the Commerce Committee. So I think at this time we'll move House File 1466 as amended to the Civil Law Committee and use that as a basis for an omnibus bill if that's the route that's chosen for these bills. I'm just moving House File 1466 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. I'm not aware of any additional business to come before the subcommittee unless somebody wants to correct me. We are adjourned.